Welcome to the Entrepreneurs Podcast. This is Peter Christo. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Norm Jenkins, a good friend and more recently the CEO of i4Connect, the recent delivery partner of the Australian Government's Accelerating Commercialisation Program, in which I was a facilitator. Norm and I met during our Masters in Entrepreneurship and Innovation back in the early 2000s and share a common experience, having both entered the military at an early age. Norm is a good guy and typifies the self-made man. In the interview, he offers some deep and important insights on innovation and entrepreneurship, both at a personal level and how it appears as a discipline in corporations and governments as they try to compete in a rapidly evolving and uncertain world. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy my interview with Norm Jenkins. Maybe we just kick off by you introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about yourself. I've known you for a long time, so I know you quite well. So if you try and spin it, I'll let the listeners know.
Thanks very much, Peter. So my name's Norm Jenkins. I come from Bacchus Marsh. I've been involved in, I guess, various entrepreneurial pursuits for many, many years. I think most of my entrepreneurial interests perhaps started really maturing when I first met you, when we began the MEI program back in, what, the early 2000s.
I started mine.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that was more me trying to find why the first couple of ventures that I'd sort of been involved in hadn't, you know, progressed the way that I thought they should. And I ended up with a bunch of businesses that would, in Tom McCaskill's word, be called the walking dead.
Right.
Yeah, yep. Because they were effectively, you know, they were just coasting along, making me a salary, yep. But I wasn't really creating value, which is yep. You know, the thing that I learnt the most in doing the MEI.
So let's go back a little bit from that and look, you know, I consider you one of the more successful entrepreneurs now, so we'll get to that. But, you know, we talk about, so just for those who don't know who Tom McCaskill was, he was the head of the MEI, the Masters of Entrepreneurship and Innovation at Swinburne for most of the 2000s, I think. Mm. Highly respected guy and a bit of a quirky human being within himself. So we'll get to all that, but I want to try and understand, kind of on the back of the conversation we just had about that young kid. So, and just again for the listeners, I had a meeting yesterday. I was advising a startup. It was really, really going well. They brought in this intern, a pimply-faced 15-year-old, and I discovered that he had convinced his parents to leave school and be an intern and homeschool himself. And I was quite astounded by that. We were talking earlier about that. What was your experience as a young man growing up in Melbourne, Australia? So Bacchus Marsh, for those who don't know, is in Victoria, the southern part of Australia. Did you fit? Like, did the educational system help you? Or because we've also got a similarity. We're both in the military, right? You're in the Navy because you couldn't get in the Army, and I was in the Army. Was that not right?
Yes, that's right. <You Yeah. did. laughs> And well, I guess my time at school was not very happy. You know, I wasn't comfortable in that school environment. I think I was a bit of a clown. I disrupted a lot of the classes that I was involved in because, I don't know, I just didn't value the way things were being delivered to me. I just felt that, you know, it was all pretty pointless.
Right.
I think I'd been exposed to my grandfather's business and he ran a fairly decent-sized business, a metal stamping factory in Moonee Ponds, or closer to Essendon probably, on Mount Road there. And it was a large enterprise. And so we would work over our different school breaks helping out at that factory. My dad worked for him as well, that was my first exposure to what, you know, you could do, what you could build up for yourself.
And, right.
And he did very well for himself over many, many years. And school was something where I just kept on hitting a lot of brick walls in terms of where I wanted to go. So you couldn't direct the conversation. You know, it was always, you know, stick to this syllabus, you know, do this, do that. And yet I was someone who wanted to find things out. And I couldn't do it in school. You know, you're
curious.
Very curious.
Yeah. Okay.
And I used to, you know, I don't know, there was magazines that we had when we were sort of smaller, Look and Learn and those, and I loved reading about that. Such a long time ago for those of you that are pretty young, you know, they were just thinking about building the space shuttles back then. And so they were talking about all the technology that was going to go into them, and I was just amazed that they were going to be able to send a ship up into space that could then come back down and land on an airfield down here.
Right, now they're doing it three times a day.
Yeah, it's crazy how it's all gone. And so that really interested me. And that level of curiosity just wasn't catered for at school. Mum and Dad, I think, were probably at their wits' end in terms of what was going on with me at school, because I used to take every Monday and Friday off because I just liked a long weekend.
Who doesn't?
And you know, when I eventually did show up at school, you know, there'd be some, you know, punishment or whatever. Right. I was always in detention
and
whatever else. And you know, I mean, that was what it was. So one day Mum says, "Norm, I've got a bit of paperwork for you here. Have a look at this," you know. And it was the application to join the Navy as a junior recruit.
Right.
And she said, "Look, you know, I think school's not for you. Maybe if you went to the Navy, they'd educate you and you'd be paid to do that." And that was like, ping, that was what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to learn, and I wanted to learn something that was useful, but I wanted to get some money, because I came from very poor, humble beginnings, you know. This is not, you know, this was a big driver, you know, for me to not be in a situation where I couldn't always have choice in my life. So I think signed the paperwork, and 6 weeks later did the testing, and about a couple of months later I was on a aeroplane over to WA, and you know, was a junior recruit at the age of 15 in the Navy.
Wow, they took them young back then.
Yeah.
They still take them that young?
No. Okay. Apparently, pardon me, apparently you can't actually enlist in a defence force with someone who's under the age of, you know, 18 anymore, you know.
Because you could, when I went in as a 17-year-old, but you just need mum and dad to sign.
Yeah. Well, mum and dad signed, obviously, for me to go in, but the Defence Force kept on having to go back to mum and dad and ask permission to do certain things with us, because we were, well, first of all, I was under the age of 16 when I joined, and then still up until the age of 18, you know, was prevented from doing a lot of the activities that you would otherwise, you know, be able to do, especially go to the bar and that with, you know, all the other people who joined them. Yeah, so, you know, that was how things went.
Yeah. So at what point did you, and or did it happen for you like this, where you thought, okay, you know, getting a payslip's not for me, I'm going to try something on my own?
Well, it probably came about more as a result of leaving the Navy, because I met my wife. I was trained as a technician. And had worked on gunfire control systems, radar, sonar over a lot of years. So I knew a lot about sort of hydraulics and control systems and things like that. And we were very well paid in the Navy. I saw it as a career for me. And when I met my now wife, I was talking about the opportunities, and the Navy contacted me and said, "Hey, we've got a posting for you. It's a 2-year posting to Seattle. You're going to pick up one of the new ships, an FFG, and you'll be in charge of the a new area on there around an electronic warfare type sort of role." So it was a great opportunity for me, and I thought, well, yeah, I'd love to pursue that. And when I went back and told Jo, my wife, about this opportunity, she said, "I'm not going to Seattle. No way. You know, I'm staying here with my family. I'm not going to go over there and you know, be away for 2 years from them." And so that made me think about, well, what I really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd seen what a lot of the other people that were married in the Navy and how their marriages were going and all that, and said, I don't want that. You know, right. I don't want to be away from my family. And so, you know, I put in my papers and resigned.
Wow. How long had you been in?
Nearly 10 years at right. that stage. I think it was 9 years and 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I just fell short of getting my long service leave.
Dude, you could have held your breath.
I know. But it was either go to Seattle or resign. So, you know, I did that. So that was probably the first turning point in my career. And so I left the Navy and, you know, knowing people that had left before me, and it was easy to get a job technically in the Navy. So I was out of the Navy once I'd left, and I went and worked with a friend of mine for a commercial shipping support company in South Melbourne. And that experience wasn't a great one because it seemed that commercially a lot of the people were just making things up as they went along. you know, things were a lot more sort of organised and you knew what you were doing, you were better trained in the Navy. So after probably 6 months or so, I decided I could do this on my own.
Right. You know,
I didn't need to be working for someone else and I'd be in charge of my own destiny. So I started a robotics company doing... I guess refurbishing robots that were, you know, welding materials handling robots at the time.
Right.
And that was sort of my first business that I started. I called it Rebot, for refurbished robotics.
Right.
That was my first foray into business, which was, I think, September 1988.
Okay. Yeah. That's about the time I got out of the army. Okay. And so how long did you have that for?
Well, that particular business, it probably morphed into a couple of different opportunities as it went along. So it began as Rebot, and then I decided that I needed to get into fabricating manipulators for the robots.
Mm-hmm.
And so a friend of mine and I and another guy, we formed a partnership around becoming a metal fabrication, sort of like OEM type business. And I think we formed that business around 1990.
Mm-hmm.
We ran that for about 2 years. And like a lot of partnerships, there began to be problems around, you know, who was taking what out of the business and who's getting paid and
who's working hard
and who's working for nothing and you know, who's taking things for, you know, out of the business. As I was earning money from other sources, because I was doing I was a sessional teacher in the TAFE system at the time. So teaching basic electronics and that to, you know, young kids and things like that at school. I was teaching licensed aircraft maintenance engineers their radio basics theory, so antenna theory, radar theory, all that sort of thing to supplement my income while we were building up these other companies.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working my ass off. And all I could see these other people doing was taking money out of the company, but not working as hard. They were leaving work at 5 and
right.
You know, I'm working 16, 17, 18 hours a day to make ends meet. Eventually I said, well, probably this is not the go to be working in a partnership where, you know, there's, you know, a lack of equity in the way the business was being operated. So I said to them, well, look, I'm going to move on and do some other things, and an opportunity came up to purchase a franchise business with Mobil Oil.
Mm-hmm.
It was around reliability engineering, so taking oil samples and doing analysis on those oil samples to work out whether there were any problems with machinery and things like that. So it was sort of a technical job, but you sort of began with a large client base from Mobil Oil and started working with them for their large lubricant customers.
Okay.
That was sort of about in 1992 that business began.
Okay, so I guess, because, you know, I know the rest of the journey, and so I would draw, kind of talking about hockey stick earlier, I would draw, in terms of the the sophistication, the change in sort of attitude towards the world of entrepreneurship and innovation, was it the MEI that kind of woke you up? What compelled you to get into the MEI later? And what woke within you during the MEI?
So what drove me to sort of look at the MEI in the first place was that I was running a number of businesses that, you know, I was working very hard, but I was still in the business.
Mm.
And I'd read that sort of Robert Kiyosaki's book,
exactly, yeah.
Cash Flow Quadrant. Rich Man, Poor Man, it was called.
Yeah.
Or Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I think it was. Yeah. And so I'd read that and I recognised that, well, I was still that technician trying to break out of, you know, being on the tools to, you know, being a manager of a larger business. So that was the first realisation. And the fact that, you know, I was just trying to make ends meet.
Mm.
And I thought, well, you know, to make ends meet, I've got to earn more. I've got to create value.
Yeah.
And so I sort of understood this value creation thing intrinsically, but I hadn't really understood it. You know, I sort of knew it, but I wasn't able to vocalise it or recognise what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the going to the MEI and deciding that I needed some academic grounding,
mm-hmm,
or some training from people that had actually done it themselves. So I started looking around. It was the MEI that spoke to that.
Mm-hmm.
So their value proposition at the time was that they had pracademics,
yep,
that,
yep,
were at the school teaching you about their experience and incorporating their experience into a master's program.
Yep.
And I thought, fantastic.
It's good.
Because I didn't want the academic thing. I wanted people, real people,
yep,
telling me how to not make the same mistakes that I was going to continue to make if I didn't learn from someone.
Right, okay.
And I didn't have my grandfather around anymore to, you know, give me any guidance.
Mm.
Dad was gone as well. So, it was, let me find another way to, take on that information.
Yeah, okay. Mm. And I guess the if we fast forward, and I know there were a couple of other ventures there as you still honed your teeth, but, I've seen the evolution of, a professional person and I guess we'll talk about I4 Connect. So we both went back into the reserves for a little while. So somehow we've got this blend of, we like the military, but not too much.
Look, the best people I've met in my working life,
yeah,
are people in the Defence Force.
Same.
Yeah. They just, they want to serve, they're dedicated, they're smart, they're great friends, trustworthy, all the values that I've held very close in my entire working life.
Mm.
And I must say, I've gone into some occupations where those values haven't been expressed in the general sort of role that I was in. I've been a real estate agent.
Yeah.
Don't get into real estate if you don't want to be someone that's, buying for, business direct from, your consumers day, yep, in, day out.
Yep.
I recognised by getting into that space, what I did wrong was I moved away from the B2B,
yep,
and went to the B2C, yep, type, stuff. Well,
yep.
And it wasn't me. It definitely wasn't me. But going back to the Defence Force side of things, why did I keep going back? I think because...
I think it was part of a conversation we had.
Yeah. Well, I think you were doing some training at the time, I think, as an officer, were you?
Yeah. I was at my first appointment.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting, is that a possibility? And I guess I was going well enough in the things that I was doing that I a common theme throughout all of the different jobs and things that I had over this time was I had just had the choice. And maybe it's the choice, but also the gumption, just try different things.
Yep.
And I just kept on trying different things. Like I was putting up TV antennas.
Yeah.
At one point,
Well, this is
all these different things that I tried.
Yeah. So there's actually a little bit of a theme here. So a previous interview I did with Sil Hawkins, he realised at a very young age where having one thing was not enough. So, the portfolio approach. So you can listen to the conversation with him. But the long and short of it was that, he instructed in martial arts. he fixed computers, and he, I can't remember, he did something else, and he always had three things going at any one time, so he could live. And I've seen that inevitably, you know, in my life too, where I've thought to myself, you know, if I've got an employer, only one person has to not like me or not want me, or for whatever reason, personal or otherwise, and put a line through my name. That's a big risk. If I've got three or four different income streams, and I keep my expenses under control, then I buy myself runway for whatever appears in the future. That obviously resonates.
Absolutely, yeah. It's almost like having a single source of income in some ways makes you beholden to that single source.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So then if I'm actually thinking about sacking a client. So I've got an IT side to my business, and I've got a small client in there who I think it's a bit of a lose-lose situation. I don't think I think they should be happy, but I don't think they are, and I'm not really happy because what I want to do for them, they don't understand. So, but I can do that. You know, I can have that conversation with them and say, I think you'd be better off with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in an employer situation, basically, well, if this person's head isn't nodding in the right way, I can't pay my bills next month or the month after. So there's a compromise there. You lose your agency. And you probably lose...
I like that word, agency. You know, I think that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but also, you know, the value that you want to extract from somebody like me or me from somebody like you is that frank and fearless ability to sit at the table and argue out, obviously respectfully, but argue out different points of view and then come to a decision around it, you know, rather than that dictatorial thing, say, okay, yes, boss. Well, ultimately, it's your business, so, you know, so even though what you're going to do, I think, is wrong. You know?
Yeah, well, I think in the various companies that I've run, the common theme has always been to have the highest level of respect for everyone that's involved in the business, knowing full well that if you've done the right thing, most of the people you've employed know a lot more than you.
Well, yeah.
You know, and so you sort of have this inbuilt respect for their capabilities, and if you can stay in your lane in terms of, you know, say, for example, what my capabilities are, and let those people do the thing that they're good at and give them the scope to do that, then you've got the best of both worlds, because you're making an income from their exertion, which is what being in business is all about, but they are happy to do that because they're respected and they've got somewhere to go.
Well, it's in their wheelhouse. They know the space that they're in. They're not forever kind of clawing. Yeah. But I saw this. So obviously, you know, you headed up the I4 Connect business. And what resonated for me, you know, aside from the work that we were doing, was your dogged focus on culture. And so, our time in the military was a dogged focus on culture. Our values, our integrity, you know, our mateship, our, you know, all those things. And then the second thing was, can you pull a trigger? Can you work a radio? Can you drive a ship? Whatever it was. And I saw it in I4. Did that just come naturally, or did you just think, what am I going to put first? No, culture.
Well, I think I had to be shown things through either books that I've read or through the education that I've, you know, undertaken over the years. And I think I've always been, you know, a learner and wanted to take information on. And one of the books that struck me the most was Jim Collins's Good to Great.
Oh, yeah. Got that.
Yeah. And I mean, that particular book, it really described, you know, the whole thing around culture and just how important that is.
Yeah.
I took that forward with me on reading that book. I think I read that, you know, back in 2003, 2004, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And in going forward, I then recognised, well, that's what I had to do with the businesses that I had going forward. So I was doing my master's program while I was also running my companies.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were, as I mentioned before, they were the sort of walking dead, and I just didn't know whether I could rectify, you know, their situation. And so I chose to actually sell off those businesses. And so then I guess in 2004 I decided I was going to do that, and it took me about 3 or 4 years to get to a point where they were ready for sale. And then I chose to do that. And then I, so that helped me get to a point where I could draw a line in the sand and say, well, from this point on, here are the new values that I'm going to go forward with in terms of the new business and new ventures that I was going to be involved in.
Right.
And, you know, best made plans didn't quite work out that way, because that was the point at which I chose to get into property game.
Real estate.
And that was the day.
No disrespect to the real estate
agents. And absolutely, no, you know, like every real estate agent I know works their ass off.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the sort of game where, you know, you're in a small town, there's a number of small real estate agencies vying for the same listings, and it becomes, you know, a he said, they said, you know, she said type, you know, situation of, you know, what's real and what's not, what's truthful and all that sort of thing. And eventually it got to the point where I just decided that it's not the space for me. I just, it wasn't where my heart was.
You've got to be a little bit like a maitre d', don't you, where you welcome them to the restaurant. And you're very charming, and you know everybody's name, and you know, and you know where they like to sit and whatever. And then you know the order's going to the cook down the back. You know, some people are more maitre d'ish, and other people are more cook. You're probably more cook.
Yeah.
You know.
And I'm sort of more of a bottom up type leader. You know, it's like I'm there to support my team. You know, I'm not there leading the team in a sense. You know, it's like encouraging the culture. The other attributes that you're seeking from a team will flow, because they recognise when everything else goes wrong, if they revert back to those primary values that we've chosen to exhibit, that they can do no wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and that guides everyone in the way they go about their business. So even though things might go wrong, as long as you've been relying on that principle and those principles, you know, you're not going to lose your job. You're not going to do anything that's not recoverable.
If you're working for the wrong person, you might lose your job, but at least your integrity will be intact.
Yeah, well, I make clear to, you know, my people that these are the values, these are the things that, you know, are not negotiable. Stick to those. You'll always have a job. You'll always have a future. You'll always, you know, be right. And don't be afraid to make a call in my absence on the basis of those principles.
Yep. Yeah.
And if it's wrong, if that client's wrong, and they're saying the wrong things, walk away.
Yeah.
All right. That's your call, because you know that's how it works.
Yeah. So would you agree with the notion that, you know, we talk about creativity, we talk about creation of value. There seems to be a driver within your personality, and I guess, you know, more broadly, you know, why do people come to the world of entrepreneurship? There seems to, and I think this has appeared to me since I've known you, that I would virtually characterize it like an artist creating their music, their painting, whatever. So would you agree that, in a way, business people who are entrepreneurial in nature are really expressing their creativity through the creation of a business and through the creation of value, and then being able to stand back and look and go, wow, like I've birthed something, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really good way to explain it. When you see a good artist, you know, and they're able to produce, you know, a drawing or a painting or a sculpture, and you look, I'm amazed that they can produce this from their hands.
Right.
Well, my hands can't produce anything like that. You know, I'm a terrible drawer. I can't sculpt. I can't do music. I have none of those skills. But the thing that I could do is I could work really hard, and I could apply the limited education that I had to try and make a difference.
Yeah.
And to not be constrained, to not be living in a world that, you know, had rules or anything like that. I could just develop what I wanted to do on my own terms. And I think that was what was important to me.
See, for you, from a character point of view, and again, having known you for so long, I've kind of seen this, you're a different guy working, you know, for you, you know, in I4 Connect. You're a different, you describe yourself as, you know, this hands-on B2B, you're fixing robots, you're fixing stuff, you know, you're technical, really. You're not that now. You're a communicator, you're articulate, you see nuance in, I guess, the dynamics within corporations and within the context of, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship. How did that come about?
It's a good point, because in the earlier days, I think, as I, you know, did the MEI, it took a while for all of that to catch. Mm-hmm. You know, like I knew I was learning a lot. And you remember Joe Griffin?
Yeah. Right.
Amazing lecturer, you know, and he brought some things out in me that I didn't realise I had.
Yep.
So that was the benefit of doing that education. But the practice of carrying out the work of being entrepreneurial over the next 10 years, say, was where that maturity happened.
Yeah.
But in the all along there, I'm raising a young family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to school. You know, things are happening. I lost, you know, my dad. I lost a brother. My wife lost her dad and her brother. Oh, you know, we lost a child.
Oh, so
you know, so life, you know, helps you grow up as well.
Yeah.
And so I guess you start to be aware that you've got to focus on the important things, the things that matter.
Mm.
And I guess that, you know, that maturity came with all those things that, you know, happened to us as we went along. And not seeing yourself as a victim, but rather that together, you know, we were going to grow and overcome those challenges in a positive way.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, you know, the idea of losing a child, you know, nobody could really contemplate that. And this was our first child, and she died after 4 days. And you know, we were unaware that there was any problem with her, but that was just, you know, something that occurred. And it changed, you know, our perception of the world and what we've been exposed to up until that time. And then other things occurred. You know, I lost my dad through cancer, and I lost my brother in a motorbike accident. And again, you know, those things, they just change you. And,
cool.
And so that change, you know, it was changes that I could have seen myself as a victim, I guess, as well. Why do these things always happen to me? You know, why am I, you know, the one that's exposed to all of this? We're all exposed to all of this at different stages in our lives. And I seem to be the first one amongst my group that was being, you know, smashed with all of these things.
Yeah. Did you sort of look up at the sky, shake your fist and go, "What? Yeah, enough on me."
I sometimes thought those early days back at school, giving those teachers and people in my class all that trouble, it's all coming back to bite me.
Right. So talk to me a little bit about, because you've got four kids,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're all very different characters.
Yeah.
How is your, character, you know, and obviously part of it is a business and entrepreneur, but obviously you've got your own characteristics as a human being. How has that affected their choices in their life in terms of, approaching, you know, for all of us, an uncertain future, and we make decisions based on what we know, and we take risks, either with our career or with businesses or with money? And are they all completely different? And obviously, you know.
Okay. Well, so this brings about another, I guess, pivotal sort of moment in my life. Probably around about 2007 or so. Kids were still fairly young, and I was making a good dollar, and pretty much the kids could have anything they wanted. They were getting lots of toys, lots of,
yeah,
you know, lots of things. And I was working harder and harder and harder, and I was away from home more and more and more.
Yeah.
And there was this point where I knew I could go really big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was just, the world was my oyster. Honestly, there was, I was involved in a space. I was in the mining game and energy industries. You know, I was, there was lots of opportunity there. Right. And I could see what was going on at home, where the kids just wanted more,
right,
more, and right, more. And I was in a position to give it to them. And I sort of decided that, no, it wasn't the way to raise, you know, these kids, that they needed to understand the sort of upbringing that I had, which was, we had nothing when we grew up. Mum and Dad tried to give us whatever they could, and we had some great grandparents that helped out as well. But we were poor. We lived in commission areas. We moved from Broadmeadows to Keilor. You know, Mum and Dad tried to buy a house in our move to Keilor, and then they failed at that, unfortunately. And we had to move out of that house back into a commission-style rental.
Right.
And then we moved to Bacchus Marsh in another commission sort of home. So we're in the commission sort of system for most of my upbringing, until I left to join the Navy. And that experience, it was very formative, you know, because it set me up to want different things in my future. And I didn't get a lot, so I thought, well, you know, I had to change my stars.
Right.
And with the way I was behaving with my own kids and how we were having the best of holidays and the kids weren't wanting for anything. I mean, we had a house with a tennis court and, you know, all of these, you know, things.
Mm-hmm.
But it just never seemed to be enough. You right. just, you know, get more and more stuff and you know, kids would keep wanting more and right. more things. And they weren't doing that in any way that they were aware of.
Well, we're pleasure seekers, aren't we? I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, what are the incentives and what are the, you know, we want more of the thing that's making us feel good. So if you give a kid, you know, 500 lollipops, they'll probably give them a good go and get sick, you know.
Well, I think, I was probably getting to a point where I was pretty unhappy with my lifestyle. You know, I was away a lot. I wasn't around for the kids during the week, and I wanted to be a parent who was present, and the only way I could do that is change my job,
right,
and move closer to home, you know, be any job at home. And that was at the point where I chose to go into real estate because it was local job.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
And so the approach to it wasn't just, I'll go and become an agent. I actually went off back to school, did the training, right, did the course. I then opened up a real estate company, employed a licensed real estate agent in there so that I could become licensed myself after working for that person as the responsible officer in the business for 12 months. So I created my own practice through my other companies funding that business and being able to pay that licensed real estate agent to work for me for that 12 months. And then I built my business up to the point where, you know, I could say, well, you know, now I'm the licensed agent and, you know, did all the quals and that sort of thing. So I approached all these things where I got the credentials along the way as I went. And that was an attempt to spend more time at home and have a better quality of life. Well, it turns out real estate agents actually work really, really hard. Right. And they're away.
They drive nice cars?
Yeah, they do drive nice cars and they make good money. But you know, you were actually, you know, away a lot,
yeah,
you know, because you do your opens and you do all the other things. And that's just how the game works. You know? Just
it's a simple business model. Open them, advertise them, get them in the door.
Yeah.
Somebody puts their hand in their pocket and says yes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And look, my hat goes off to those that actually make a success out of that business because they are very driven and are very client-focused and they do a good job. So Culturally, it wasn't the right space and yeah. wasn't the right choice for me. I think the attempt about getting closer to home was what that was all about.
Mm.
And so I went into that real estate side of things as well as into business broking.
Mm.
So I became a business broker, got all those creds and that sort of thing along the way to be a business broker. And funnily enough, my MEI experience and the other businesses that I've been involved in set me up very well to have a very good business broking practice.
Uh-huh.
And so I was helping people sell their companies. That was a great job while I had it. But it also was a thing where the bigger I became, the more I was away,
yep.
the more I was exposing my family to mm. less of me
mm.
where I didn't want that. I wanted them to have more of me. I wanted more of them. I wanted to go and watch their, you know, their games, their, yeah. their sports and be involved and that sort of thing. And so that was a big driver.
So tell us, I mean, you've got some success, some real success happening in your kids. You want to tell us what they're doing?
Yeah, so we've got, one of my boys is a professional UFC fighter. Jack, he's been fighting now for close to 10 years. He's worked his way up. In fact, I was talking about this in the sauna at my gym this morning with someone and saying, I think to be a fighter and to live through the privation that he has over the last 10 years to get where he is, you have to have a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit as well.
Right. Okay.
So I think he has that. Like, he's driving Great. His own future, you know, and mm. and he wants to have that, his choice for himself. So I'm, you know, really proud of him and what he's doing there. His older brother, Tim, he was in the army for a while. He was an armourer and so trained as a fitter and turner. He's left that job, and Tim's actually in America at the moment training on turbines with Siemens in Houston, he is then coming back to look after most of the emergency power generation at, you know, hospitals and things like that in Victoria. So you know, he's just taken on that very important job. So you know, he's doing really well. Ben, my oldest boy, has recently left the police force and he's now working in a role around security and that sort of thing now. So Ben's doing amazingly well in his role. And Kate, my daughter, is raising a child. She's working for V-Line as a customer experience officer.
Yeah.
She worked with us in I4 Connect, looking after the marketing and that side of the business as well. So, you know, all my kids have gone along very well. They're all, you know, buying houses and
mm-hmm.
and in relationships and, you know, I think, you know, you could, if you look at what you'd like from your family, you want them to be happy. I've got 4 grandchildren.
Right.
They're, I guess, the type of kids where you just want to be around them and you want to actually be involved. So I'm due to pick up my, you know, grandkids from different times at schools, and I go to them with, you know, for swimming and right. get in the water with them and that sort of thing. I'm sort of filling in for my kids when they can't be there and doing yep. other things. So that's
being present.
That's great. Again, being present is a thing. And now, you know, I've got the ability to be around. You know, it's great. And my kids are really comfortable with that as well, I think. So
yeah. So let me just go back to you know, we there's an, I guess, a changing landscape in my view when it comes to innovation and entrepreneurship in the military, defence, in government, in large corporations like BHP and all that sort of thing. Could you articulate what's going on as far as you're concerned and what the problems are that need to be solved if we're going to, I mean, there's a big pivot going on to bring manufacturing back in Australia, to be more agile within the workplace, to be able to accommodate a changing landscape. You know, I know the you know, government departments, you know, pivoting into Southeast Asia, and we're doing all sorts of interesting, in inverted commas, things there, which is requiring some creative thought. What do you think's lacking, and what do you think we could do better as a country from an innovative, to be a more innovative and entrepreneurial society? It's a big question, I think.
That is a big one. I think that the problem that I see in a lot of this landscape at the moment is people sort of not, you know, playing in their particular wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. So I see there's a lot of drive to make things happen in industry at in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But my belief is that industry or problems that need to be solved are going to be solved by people that recognize those problems and are, if you like, wanting to create the solutions, you know, that are required.
Yep.
But there's this friction between a lot of the mindset of, I guess, what I would regard as the up and coming entrepreneurs and innovators away from, say, activities that would have them align to things like national security, for mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm.
And then that comes along with the idea that, or not the idea, but the reality that here in Australia, we tend to knock down people that are not successful, you know, mm-hmm. that try something and, you know, mm-hmm. fail.
Mm-hmm. Is it just that, or is it just, I agree with you 100%. Mm-hmm. I also, you know, in that article I wrote, I used the word unconventional. We don't like the unconventional.
Oh, yeah, and I think that's because we have far too much bureaucracy and, if you like, public service mentality surrounding the, I guess, the programs that the government would otherwise run
mm-hmm.
to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so things have to happen in a certain way and you know, there's a certain order to things. And some of those have been quite successful, but some have been atrociously unsuccessful.
Mm.
And, you know, lots of money spent with, you know, virtually no outcome, and defence and other government departments are all, I guess the origin of those failures,
mm.
but there's no one accountable
failures. Yeah. That even happened here in Victoria during COVID, and
mm.
you know, no one could point to one person to be accountable, or at least, you know, a couple of people to be accountable on decisions being made. What is it culturally that needs to change? Because these are not dumb people, so I wonder whether there's what drives, like, you know, the simple business is driven by profit, right?
Mm.
You're making widgets, you make more, at a lower price, you make more money. The incentives within a bureaucracy, even in a private company, if it's large enough, is really different to the profit motive. It's also power, I guess, and it's a title, it's influence, it's better than the next person. Is that it? How do you change that?
Oh no, I've sort of been thinking of something as you've been talking, in the way I see things is that as an entrepreneur, or you know, with trying to inculcate an entrepreneurial mindset and people wanting to get into this space, it's about solving problems,
mm-hmm.
and to do it in a scientific way, you know, to go forward on the basis of exploring a particular problem and then deciding, is that problem the one that you should go after?
Mm.
And then having decided that, then it's then, well, you know, a selection process around the potential ways that you could solve that, and investigating the market to find out, well, which of those solution approaches is going to be the one that really, you know, provides all the ticks, you know, for the market, so that you can bring something to fruition that actually people want to buy.
Mm.
I think what's happening now is we're trying to overlay a bunch of other requirement around the solution to the problem. So now we're trying to make it socially responsible, that the governance framework is appropriate, that environmentally, you know, it's got to satisfy a certain range of parameters. And, you know, the problem doesn't care about all of those other things. These are impositions on the entrepreneurial and innovation process that are trying to be put into it that actually will stunt the opportunity for those you know, things to go ahead. Pure and simple, we've got to look at what it is we're trying to, what problems we're trying to solve, and decide that we do want to go and solve those. And we've got to be smart about the solutions we put into place, that so some of those solutions can take that into account. But eventually someone's going to have to pay. And the price that they're going to pay when the imposition of all of those other things comes in and the price is outside of, you know, their idea of what they're willing to pay, it goes nowhere.
Absolutely right. Do you think, you know, we probably have to walk a fine line here, but do you think that merit has been devalued as part of the selection, as about, you know, as part of one of the things that we look at when trying to allocate the right people to the right roles because of these other factors?
Yeah. Pure and simple. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that we're moving away from a merit-based approach to, you know, how we go about employing people, let alone, you know, deciding whether a particular venture should proceed or not. When you're imposing a range of ideologies on the way things should proceed. Look, I think there's always the case that in a, I guess a government-funded operation, that you can experiment with certain approaches to see how that plays out. But in a government-run enterprise, say, for example, i4Connect, it was a business solely funded as a delivery partner of, you know, the government's entrepreneurs program. And in that, because I was the key person in that business, I had the ability to choose to operate that business with a broader scope of parameters around what culture it should have, how harsh we would treat the people in the business about the achievement of, you know, certain performance criteria and those sorts of things that would change the nature of, I guess, the way people did their jobs. And so it meant that I could do some experimentation virtually with the money that I was, you know, or i4Connect was being paid to do this job, that otherwise, you know, in a business with many shareholders and, and where, you know, they're looking for a return on their investment, they would perhaps question, you know, the scope that I was being allowed to exploit the money coming in to operate the business the way I was. So what I'm saying is that it's only through the government service that you can do that, because commercial drivers impact everything else. And when the government tries to impose a bunch of drivers that are not commercial on business, it then becomes...
It's not a market force.
It then becomes a real problem, because how are we going to compete on a global scale? How are we going to sell our products and services to overseas opportunities when we've loaded them up with a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, taxes, other impositions on the business, payroll taxes, and other, you know, you just load up all of these different costs.
Which takes capital out of the market. You could be allocating that capital to grow the business, hire more people, you know, invest in technology, whatever. That's kind of been taken off.
Oh, yeah, you know,
these pressures, and so therefore you're left with a thinner opportunity to kind of scale. Whereas the conversation is, let's scale. Let's make, you know, let's you know, add value to the gross domestic product of the country, and, you know, pay more taxes and therefore help the country. But there's a counterforce there. We're saying, okay, we're going to squeeze you further and further because we've got to pay for all these other...
And a lot of these considerations are sort of outside the value proposition that you're trying to create in the products and services that you are developing. Mm. You know, your value proposition isn't necessarily going to be enhanced through the imposition of some of these things. Now, no. Perhaps there is to a certain select section of the market, but largely people will buy on the basis of the value they see in the price they're being charged.
Yeah,
and it all comes back to that. Mm. And here we are, you know, I guess in a world now where there's a whole bunch of other stuff happening that's imposing a certain way of operating on businesses, or trying to impose that. And I see, you know, lots of organisations, you know, that are supposed to be, if you like, the leading organisations within various things going on. I won't say who they are, but they are trying to, if you like, re-educate everyone around the things that they should be doing. Mm. But in actual fact, what they're trying to do is impose these ideologies on the value propositions to the customer, but the customer sometimes or most often won't actually pay for that.
No. To actually to get that moment of truth where you stick your hand in your pocket and you pull out your hard-earned cash and you go, okay, that's valuable for me. Here you go. That is the real price discovery piece.
Yeah, and it's also a timescale thing as well. So I think we're growing up, maturing in terms of how we're producing new products and services, and we're aware of the damage to the planet that we're doing, and you know, we know we have to look at call it cradle to grave type approaches to everything that we're doing, so that you can't produce a product knowing that it becomes a pollutant, you know, into our system time goes on.
That's about visibility of that externality, right?
Yeah.
So if you can quantify that, then yeah, you should be paying for it. There should be a fully realised cost. You know, it's economics, right?
Exactly.
A fully realised cost. So that glass costs, you know, a dollar to make, but you haven't taken into account that you're polluting the river and, you know, kids are getting sick down the thing and somebody's paying for their healthcare, and you're impeding their opportunities for their life, then that's not a true cost of that glass.
Yeah, but it's also at the same time when you've got a market out there and, you know, you're bringing other products and services into the market that don't have those same requirements on them.
Well, that's right.
You know, so here we are loading up the way that we operate with all of these other considerations and cost base, you know, that you know, other manufacturers or, you know, people from other areas don't have to worry about. And here we are trying to compete under those circumstances. Yeah, we can't.
Yeah. You know, so polluting the river is not an ideology. That's a reality. Mm. You may not pay it, but putting an ideology cost within the construction, you know, the manufacturing of that product, then you're not competing. You can't compete fairly with the other person that hasn't had that imposed upon them.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's about, you know, making sure that if you want to run with that particular philosophy around producing products and services that, you know, don't impact the environment, for example, well, you've got to be able to compete on the same level playing field as all of the other providers of those products, and not be left hung out to dry when the next government changes their mindset and says, oh, well, we're not going to impose tariffs on these products and services that have, you know, these lower costs because they don't take into account those things where those things are made.
Yeah.
And then they're trying to make the price differential less when it comes to the end user. When that disappears, and so I know, well, we've got to remove tariffs and remove it. You know, they're obviously mostly gone now. So that can't be the case. You know, we've got to have a situation where if we're going to become a a manufacturing country of note where we're getting back into sovereign capability and that sort of thing, we've got to make sure that the places that we get into, we can compete on a world scale, because we'll only get back to where we came from if we're only manufacturing goods and services for ourselves. That's just not going to work. No. We cannot survive doing that. So we've got to have global markets that we're selling into, and we've got to be able to create products and services for those global markets at a price that they're going to pay.
Yeah. So do you think that there's the CEO of Qantas used the word market distortion. Do you think that, you know, I see government as really being, should be an enabler, like enabling things to happen rather than making things happen. And they talk about we created jobs when the government doesn't create jobs. You know, do you think there's an overreach or a misunderstanding on how, you know, letting the market run freely and efficiently, where you know, a lot of these sorts of programs actually distort the market?
Well, I think there are strings that the government can pull, I believe, and not fall afoul of making the wrong call on what strings to pull.
Mm.
And you know, there's some fundamental things there that we know we've got to keep producing food, and we've got to keep, you know, and the food's got to be at a value point that, you know, we can afford to pay for, and we've got to keep producing energy, and we've got to, all of these things. But at some point, you know, people have to decide that, well, the push to remove, say, coal out of the, you know, the energy supply chain, it's got to happen eventually, because, you know, it's not a very clean form, but there's lots of cleaner forms of coal energy production or coal-based energy production that we can pursue in the intervening period before we get to a no-coal situation.
Yeah.
But when we get to a point in this whole discussion where anything that we create is going to be created on the basis of a need only in Australia, then to me that's where government has to really appreciate, just don't go down that path.
Just
go away from that. So I don't know how they're going to be able to pull the strings appropriately to do that with the NRF and the direction that's going to take, now with the new industry growth program, because, you know, they're very much aligned in terms of the pursuits that they're going to have, to be in a position of understanding that the decisions about who gets the money is then going to drive the creation of companies producing products and services at certain price points that are going to be paid by, first of all, the Australian need. They've also got to create the efficiencies and the value for those products and services to be sold into overseas markets. But we've got to understand that the overseas markets actually want them. Do the work, do the necessary work, because, you know, that's the key. You know, like so many times we've created duplicate industries here in Australia where we knew the efficiencies that they had were so far away. And, I mean, what did we do with the automotive industry for so many years? We stumped them up, gave them money, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars to try and stay open, for them to eventually close because, well, commercially, they just couldn't keep the doors open and make a car for a price point that, you know, meant something. And once one fought, it was a domino effect because it was an ecosystem. You know, I was working in that game when I first got into robotics, and, you know, lots of robots in various car manufacturing plants around the planet, and all of their downstream providers of parts, all of them had, you know, robots or automation of some sort or another. And as soon as one manufacturer fell over, the viability of those other parties in the supply chain, you know, became questionable. And then, you know, it was a domino effect. Once one went, they all started going. Yeah. And I was there for the entirety of that.
Yeah, but some of them reinvented themselves. They went and did new things.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was possible, but it was a major disruption. I mean, there's still factory sites around the country now where they're just sort of ghost cities. Yeah, just big factories that, you know, have nothing going on in them.
I guess it's part of the course, you know, inevitably, you know, when things change, you know, the Blockbusters close down, the Kodaks, you know, I don't think there's an argument to protect, you know, the status quo for too long. I think if you see a trend change, like some sort of a creative destructive technology, you know, the internet, AI is happening now, I think you've got a plan for the winding up of that way of doing things in some sort of an orderly manner, because people need, you know, you can't have a sudden stop where people can't, you know. But we need you can't hold back the tide of those sorts of changes. Like AI is going to affect particularly white collar jobs. So they're not affecting the plumbers and the tradies, and, you know, I mean, maybe it will to a degree, but they won't lose their jobs. I think they're safe and secure because they actually can do things. Mm. They can turn them up, you know.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the people that are tinkering around with spreadsheets and, you know, writing up, you know, like that article that I wrote this morning, I knocked it out. I mean, I wrote it. It was an abomination, but I chat GPT cleaned it up for me. I touched it up and I was done.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And it might have taken me all day.
And I might say it was very well written, Pete.
Well done, ChatGPT. Unfortunately, I put both the draft and the chat initially to change it. I might ask you just as one final question, maybe to just provide some advice to those sort of embarking on, you know, the entrepreneurial journey now. Maybe they're, you know, they're younger, or even if they're older, or they're, you know, people who are kind of setting up side hustles. What would be the, you know, two or three things that you might give them as advice?
What could I offer as advice? I think probably the idea that you just don't give up, you know, like the dream is something that you always have to hold on to, whatever your dream is. I've always kept that foremost in my mind. And my dream, I think, was always to be in charge of my own destiny,
mm-hmm.
you know, to always have choice and to provide, you know. I mean, that's my fundamental sort of orientation, you know. I had to provide for my family, and that meant that I had to morph into different things at different times to meet that requirement. As I've said, I had to, not just me, because, you know, Jo, my wife, my partner, made many sacrifices along the way to allow me the scope to explore these other opportunities that as they came up. And that meant, you know, for months and years at a time, we had not a lot.
Mm.
And the kids were exposed to that.
Mm.
And I comforted myself with that on the basis that, well, that's not going to hurt them.
Mm.
You know what I mean? We're still there. We're still providing, you know, dinner on the table and, you know, a loving environment for them to grow up in.
Mm.
You know, giving them some direction, as a parent, you know, that's you know, something that's great. So you've got to be able to not have balance, but have I guess I'll call it intention, you know, in your life, and you know, that's sort of the other aspect of this. My intention has always been to be a provider, and to be a good example, whether that's to my kids or to people that I'm working with or for, or people who are working for me, always to be that, and to be respectful of people that I'm involved with right throughout the whole like value chain of the businesses that I've been involved with. Mm. Recognise that everyone has different capabilities, and that me, perhaps most of all, is exploiting all of those as I need to along the way to get where I want to go. So I owe them. Mm. You know, it's that mutuality. You know, we're not here on our own. It's a team effort, and recognizing that the people that you work with are responsible as much for your success as you have been in providing an opportunity for them to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a pretty amazing place to be. So if you get a lot out of helping other people, and maybe this goes back to our defense sort of thing, you know, to want to serve, to recognize that serving others is actually, you know, a pretty idealistic sort of life, you know, to know that you can help others get to where they want to go. And you know, I mean, it's not just totally giving, you know, because you're receiving.
Sure, it's a two-way street.
Yeah. So I think that hopefully that sort of answers that question in a way that other people can perhaps understand. So I guess service, respect, and
maybe
you know, keep your eye on the prize. You know,
bit of grit. Stick to what you're doing.
Resilience. You know.
Yeah.
Wake up every day knowing that, well, you just got to get up and keep going, and that in the end it's on you, you know. Nobody's going to, you know, say take the day off.
That's, you know, right. What is that?
yeah. Take the day off. You know, you can just not go to work because, I don't know, you don't feel up to it, or you know, you feel like you're a bit worn out.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in this space.
No.
You're driven to achieve, and that means getting up every day, getting into it, you know, making small gains, and when you don't, well, you know, suck it up and keep going.
Well, that's a fantastic point to leave it. Thanks, Norm. Thank you so much for doing this today. All the best on what's next. I'll be very interested to hear. Maybe we'll have you in again in a year or so, hopefully, if this thing is still going well.
Thanks very much, Pete, and thank you, everyone.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Norm Jenkins. Please note that the AC program is now closed, so I4 is not operating anymore in that capacity. This podcast is sponsored by my business, Christo Partners. Christo Partners offers advice and consulting services to startups and new venture managers in corporates, governments, and NGOs. If you're looking for help in developing your idea, commercializing, or raising capital, contact us at christopartners.com or via email at hello@christopartners.com. This is Peter Christo. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care and stay curious.